I'm going to preface going into the populations right now with the question from Masayo that she was telling
okay.
us that we couldn't hear, because it has to do with autism. And I know
okay.
that I know that I put in the videos on autism, and of course I put in the videos on my grandnephew Jordan
mm-hmm.
on cerebral palsy.
Right.
It's not an area that many of us will come in contact with, but if we do, it's good to have some information about, you know, what to expect. But it does give our folks the scope of understanding what music therapists are trained to work with. But here's Masayo's question. She says that I heard in my brain that that bad sound that gave me a headache as a jet passed over the sky. I was bothered by the sound one of the videos this month because it was about a girl with autism. She enjoys the piano now, but a year or two ago, she cried over the same sound. How do you know if your sound is not bothering patients when the patient cannot communicate with you? That music therapist went on with the therapy with piano even when the girl cried. How do you know that it's okay to do it, Masayo?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. Well, I think even in a nonverbal, non-responsive client, such as someone, you know, near death in a hospice, they do react. You just have to watch carefully. I mean, do their eyes flutter? Do the not the overt crying, that's another thing, but they do react. And so you have to be sensitive to that. You have to be really focused on the client. And I know that Tina is working with you on that and focusing on that. In the case, I'd have to know what the music therapist was trying to accomplish with this girl. You're assuming the sound was bothering her. It may have been, and she would have to look at that and determine that. But it also might be that the kid had just gotten to a point of, you know, more behavioral problems or non-physically based obstinance, and they were trying to break through that so they continued to work with that on her. I would need to know what the goals are and what more about the client to know that. If they felt that it did determine that the sound itself was really bothering her or hurting her, like the sound hurt your head, then yes, they should stop. They should try something else. I mean, the basic principle of music therapy, you do what is best to get the client happy and participating, you know, not just to, you know, make them happy, but, you know, to push through those difficulties. And if piano doesn't work, then you try singing with them, or you try percussion, or, you know, you try any number of things that we have to interact with the client. So, yes, if it was physically hurting her, and that can happen, they can become more sensitive to sounds. She maybe she was ill, maybe she had a stuffy head. I mean, it's just really hard to say. If it really was physically bothering her, causing her discomfort or pain, absolutely she should have stopped. If they had determined that that was not what was going on and it was more a stubborn or a acting out behavior, there might have been some reason to keep pushing to break through that so that the client would work with her more in the way she wanted. But, you know, it's not an exact science. You know, you're trying stuff, you're doing the best you can, you're watching very carefully, you're trying to be mindful and in the present moment. But, you know, you're not a mind reader. You know, she could be upset because her mommy didn't give her a cookie, you know, before she came in the session. And it's very hard to know. So you just, you know, you try the best you can. You try to be as focused on the client as possible. And then you make your therapeutic judgments based on that. If it doesn't work, try something else. That's my best answer for that.
So would you like to touch upon some of the populations now? Probably the one that we're going to come in contact with most is nursing homes and people with Alzheimer's
right.
or dementia.
Okay, I'll focus on that mostly. Okay, well, when you're dealing with a nursing home population, you are actually dealing with a very small percentage of the total number of older Americans over the age 65. So I'm approaching that. I don't think that's very old anymore, but that's the definition. And they are, for us, called geriatric clients or patients, if you use that terminology. Usually in a nursing home, they don't say patients, to tell you the truth. They say residents often. Hospice is a little bit different. So, again, we're dealing with people who have, by definition, problems being able to live independently. That's what a geriatric client is. They can no longer safely live independently. And so they are in a special housing situation, skilled care center, nursing home, something. And they have entered a stage in the natural aging process called senescence. And here I am writing on the board, S-E-N-E-S-C-E-N-C-E, senescence. And this is the stage of life where the natural process of decay and degeneration is no longer balanced by the repair mechanism. You know, if a 20-year-old goes on a ski trip and breaks their hip, yeah, they'll be in a cast for a while, but it'll heal. If a 50-year-old person breaks their hip, they may be in a cast longer and have to have physical therapy. If an 18-year-old person falls and breaks their hip, they could likely die. It's because that 80-year-old person is in senescence and their body can no longer repair the natural process of aging or sudden problems. So we are dealing with people who have problems, not just Alzheimer's and dementia, but other things. Some of the things that you should be aware of as you start to work with clients in geriatric settings. One is that their vision may be fairly impaired. The incidence of blindness increases as we get older. Certainly the farsightedness, the needing reading glasses, which I have on right this moment. They need more light to see, cataracts, all kinds of things. So when you enter a room, they may not see you. I mean, you may assume they saw you walk in the door, but they may not have. So you need to have, you know, what I tell my students, your entry speech, what you say, so you don't startle them. And you don't want to rely on vision necessarily. If you're having them play the harp, be sure they can see it. And if not, give them touch cues. But just be aware of that. Hearing is also very, very affected as we age naturally. Not even diseases like diabetes and internal sounds like tinnitus, the ringing in the ears and that sort of thing. As we age, our perception of frequencies shrinks, particularly the high frequencies, quite a bit by the time people are in their 80s. They also, the overall loudness level that they need to hear things increases, and that's why if you're visiting an elderly relative and you're watching television and it's 40 times louder than you would like it to be, it's because they need more loudness to hear it than they did before. All this is natural part of aging. They don't have to be deaf to have these problems. But the incidence of actual deafness is quite high in this geriatric housed population. If you are working with them sitting in chairs rather than lying in bed, or might want them to stand up to do something, also know that their balance is often very impaired. They don't have that solidity, a feeling of where they are. They get very anxious because they're afraid they're going to fall. They could fall, which we certainly want to avoid. So you have to be aware of that and not ask them to move too quickly or stand up too quickly or help them. That's more for music therapy practice perhaps than what you do. But those of you who are working with the Rainbow of Harps, you might have people sitting in a circle working on the harps rather lying in bed, so you want to be aware of that. All the senses change. The sense of touch becomes less acute. One thing I worry a little bit about is to make sure you are all aware that they, because their sense of touch is diminishing, they may not realize that their fingers are getting raw. They may not feel that, and so they may play to a point of hurting themselves, rubbing their fingers raw. So you have to kind of watch that, because they may not know they're doing that. So you have to, again, be watchful, be careful, particularly if you're teaching them to play harps or they're using the rainbow harps or whatever. Obviously, physical functioning changes, although as in all things, if you keep using it, you keep it functioning. So those who you are working more with for wellness and prevention of problems, and again, I think the rainbow of harps is really great for that. that just by keeping their hands moving and, you know, having to use their arms and everything that you do, that's really good for them. And plus it's exercising their brain, and that's another really good thing for them. Some of them may have arthritis, and so, again, you have to be aware of that. If they say it hurts, it probably does. You may have to think of alternative ways for them to participate. That's one thing music therapists do a lot, is to adapt and find ways that they can participate and still accommodate their particular needs. They do fatigue easily, and they and so, again, if you would normally be working with them physically with harps for 45 minutes, you may have to cut that down to 15 or 20. But again, if you're playing at the bedside, that's another thing.
Right.
Now, the problems of the brain, dementia. Dementia is a group of symptoms, and there are a number of causes of those symptoms, and Alzheimer's is one of them. So you have dementia of the Alzheimer's type, dementia, which is cardiovascular. This was what used to be called hardening of the arteries. The blood isn't getting to the brain. You can have dementia due to stroke. You can have dementia due to medicine interactions. That's far more common than you would imagine. But the one that we're focused on, of course, is Alzheimer's, because it is a growing problem. The more of my generation that moves into our golden years, there's going to be more incidents, because the incidence of Alzheimer's increases with age, unless it is early onset Alzheimer's, which is a slightly different thing, but still causes the same symptoms. So what are the symptoms of dementia? Forgetfulness, confusion, restlessness, wandering, getting lost in their own houses, increasing difficulty with short-term memory. At first, their long-term memories will be intact, but they won't, they'll remember what they did on D-Day, but they won't remember what they had for lunch. So short-term memory. So they, you know, if you've been visiting them every day for 3 weeks and you come in and they say, "Who are you?" Don't get insulted. They just really don't remember. As the disease progresses, they begin to lose those long-term memories, and they begin to do what's known as time displacement. They will have a memory that they think is current. And so this is when they'll get incredibly agitated, because they have to go pick their daughters up at school. But that happened 45 years ago. Or I had one woman who I was working with who just was almost in hysterics because she had to go to the basement and feed the cat. But she's in a nursing home. There is no basement. There is no cat. But she is time displacing. And those memories are as real to them as reality as in the moment as ours are. So it doesn't help to say, "Oh, now, come on, that was 45 years ago." You have to address the panic they're feeling, the upset, the anger, because it's real to them and they're experiencing it. Another characteristic is the sundowner syndrome. Something happens about 4 or 5 o'clock when they think they have someplace to go, you know, come home from work or go someplace. And this is when they will get very agitated and try to leave and can't understand why you're, you know, telling them that they can't go out the door and that kind of thing. They can become combative. They can become hostile. They don't understand that they're not remembering things. They, you know, if they ask you something and you have gotten it for them or told them, they don't remember that. They think you didn't do it. They get mad at you. This is when you have to be a little careful of your harp. They will strike out. You know, a little distance isn't bad. If you get too close physically to them, they oftentimes will raise their hand and shake their fist at you. That's a real good cue to back off a little bit, because they're feeling intruded on or afraid. These people live in a constant state of terror. They don't know who they are. They don't know where they are. They don't know who you are. They don't know what's going on. And they live in this state of abject terror all the time. So we have to have empathy for that. So we don't want to crowd them. We want to urge them, but we don't want to push them too hard. If you say, "What's your favorite song?" They will oftentimes will say things like, "Oh, I wouldn't know that, dear," because they don't remember. And if you keep pressing them, they get agitated because they know they're supposed to know that, but they really don't know what you're talking about. So you have to watch their reactions. You need to protect them physically, and you need to protect you and your heart physically. They don't mean to be, I mean, you know, it's not a calculated, "I'm going to hit this person now." It's just their only way of saying how upset and terrorized they are.
Barb, this is a good time to interject this question. Karen Team says, "Watching the Alzheimer's video, which we had posted, about the man whose family seemed to turn him on with music. She said, it really disturbed me that the family felt that they were making a connection with him, and it just seemed to me that it was more of a respond on demand versus a connection. How can we tell the difference and know when we're really connecting?"
Well, I don't understand why respond on demand is a bad thing, I guess, is what I'm reacting to. If they sit there blankly staring and then they react to something, even if it's because you've turned the music on and said, "Come on, Dad, clap," I don't see why that's a bad thing. I mean, to me, that is the connection. They are responding to the environment, which is the people in the music who are asking them to respond, and whereas usually they're in either a stupor or they're literally living in a different century, I mean, a different time, a different place. They're not, I mean, to me, it's that if you respond to the music, you are responding to what is real in the environment at that moment. And if you acknowledge somebody in the environment who's really there, because you get Alzheimer's patients who are talking to who knows who aren't there physically, to me, that's plus. That's good. I mean, it's not like training a dog, if that's what she's thinking of.
Well,
it really is finding the thing that will, the music, the thing that will pull them out of that lethargy, at least for a little, that fog, at least for a certain amount of time. Okay, so in working with Alzheimer's patients, you know, what you're being trained to do, to watch their movements, their breathing, try to find their a resonant code, is really perfect for working with these clients, and the use of music from a time when they would probably remember it. So if they're Irish music. If they're from the, you know, when they were teens and in their 20s, in the 40s, go with that music. Go with traditional folk music. Go with religious music, because that's what they're going to respond to. Things that are familiar to them, those memories will come for a long time after a lot of things are gone. Even their ability to play music will stay intact for a long time. So if they play piano or they play something, they oftentimes can still do that very late into the Alzheimer's process. And it's a wonderful thing to do that, because they are more normal than anything there. And they may not, you know, if you say to them, "Play Clair de Lune," and they may not remember it, but if you put them at the piano, they'll start to play it.
Barb,
that memory will stay for a long, long time.
Barb, I just want to interject that one of the things that I have found is that if you are given a session, let's say 1 hour, and you go in and you just play the harp for 1 hour, depending on the group that you're working with, I really draw from my music therapy training when I'm in a group to keep things moving and changing. And that's where I think the training that I got, incorporating a theme, but incorporating movement, incorporating singing, doing a little bit of playing, doing some rhythm instruments. Last week I was with my mother's assisted living, and I wish the person who was taking pictures had turned the camera on, because it would have been great. But, you know, we were able to do some, everybody was sitting with their walkers, but they were able to do, you know, tapping of their heels together. And I was able to talk to them about how that's going to help the bladder meridian, so that if you do that, then it helps, you know, if you have UTIs, not to, you know, activate those meridians. One of the things with the rhythm instruments is rather than just having, you know, people playing triangles and bells, you know, to keep in time with the music, this group is pretty functional. So we created different patterns. So the wood blocks did the one, and the triangles did the three, and then we'd go one, two, three, four. And so they knew that they had to kind of do something on a certain beat, and it really sounded great. And as a result of that, we had people who actually said they were interested in doing a handbell choir. So that's one of the things that I'm looking forward to in the future is getting a set of handbells and working with them. And, of course, at the end, you know, we had our refreshments with Irish Bailey's cream and alcohol. They all thought they were, you know, doing something forbidden and everything. And it was really quite fun. I wish I had some pictures to share. But the point of me bringing this up is that keeping it diversified, and I have my whole St. Patrick's Day thing on a PowerPoint because I, you know, show the words up on the thing so they can read the words along. But the PowerPoint is so large that it doesn't seem to be able to boot over very easily. But I think what I'll try to do is to burn some of the discs, have it, you know, something like this on a PowerPoint so people can start planning out when you go into a session with people, you really want to have a plan that you're working with instead of just going in and, I mean, you can wing it to a certain extent, but it's good to have a structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's as you said, that's very much part of what music therapy practice is that find that thing that the client will respond to. And one of the things that I've been doing recently, we've started a wellness center at our music therapy clinic here on campus, and we are bringing in what sounds like with your folks there, what I would call well elderly. I mean, they're not impaired at all. I mean, they're there in a day program or, you know what I mean? And we are beginning to combine music instruction with some music therapy principles so that they're both learning musical skills. And this, again, is where the Rainbow of Harps would come in fabulously.
Yeah.
While we have them there, they're socializing. We have some discussions if somebody has had a problem come up. We had one woman who said she was feeling very down when she came in. She was a pianist. She wanted to play the piano, so we let her play the piano. And afterwards, she said, "I really feel much better." So in good therapist style, we had a little discussion about, well, what was it about playing the piano that helped lift her mood? And then we generalized it to everybody. And I think there's a real market out there for not only music therapy, but for therapeutic carpus to in the well elderly community that isn't being tapped at all. The prevention of problems, the prevention of emotional problems, or keep them physically active so that they don't have the physical problems. Keep their brains active by learning something new, which is shown to slow down the progression of Alzheimer's. We've got those tools, and I think we can use them not only with the people who are already severely impaired by Alzheimer's, but the ones who we might help keep their active, happy, older years going longer.
Right.
So they don't have to go to the nursing home.